Blog Talk Radio.
There comes a time when we heed a certain when the world must come together as one. There are people dying, oh, it's time to lend a hand to life. The greatest gift of
no.
world community. Today, all of our cities confront huge problems. All of our cities are potentially powder kegs as a result of the continued existence of these conditions. Many in moments of anger, many in moments of deep bitterness, engage in riots. Let me say, as I've always said, I will always continue to say, that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating. I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for freedom and justice. I feel that violence will only create more social problems than they will solve, that in a real sense it is impractical for the Negro to even think of mounting a violent revolution in the United States. So I will continue to condemn riots and continue to say to my brothers and sisters that this is not the way. Continue to affirm that there is another way. But at the same time, it is as necessary for me to be as vigorous in condemning the conditions which cause persons to feel that they must engage in riotous activities as it is for me to condemn riots. I think America must see that riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society, which must be condemned as vigorously as we condemn riots. In the final analysis, a riot is the language of the unheard. What is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met. It has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, equality, and humanity. So in a real sense, our nation's summers of riots are caused by our nation's winters of delay. As long as America postpones justice, we stand in the position of having these recurrences of violence and riots over and over again. Social justice and progress are the absolute guarantors of riot prevention. Now let me go on to say that if we are to deal with all of the problems that I've talked about, if we are to bring America to the point that we have one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, there are certain things that we must do. The job ahead must be massive and positive. We must develop massive action programs all over the United States of America in order to deal with the problems that I have mentioned. Now, in order to develop these massive action programs, we've got to get rid of one or two false notions that continue to exist in our society. One is the notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. I'm sure you've heard this idea. It is the notion almost that that is something in the very flow of time that will miraculously cure all evil. I've heard this over and over again. There are those, and they're often sincere people, who say to Negroes and their allies in the white community that we should slow up and just be nice and patient and continue to pray, and in 100 or 200 years, the problem will work itself out, because only time can solve the problem. I think that is an answer to that myth. And it is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. And I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme righteous in our nation, have often used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. It may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words of the bad people and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere we must come to see that social progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. And so we must help time. We must realize that the time is always right to do right. And that's another notion that gets out. It's around everywhere. It's in the South, it's in the North, it's in California, and all over our nation. It's the notion that legislation can't solve the problem. It can't do anything in this area.
When we first opened the restaurant, there was a more customers. DoorDash put me on the map. I love it.
I see firsthand every single day just how important mental health services are. When he ran for governor, J.B. Pritzker said he'd fight to expand those services. And that's exactly what he did. And I know he'll keep fighting for us.
Thank you very kindly, my friend. As I listen to Ralph Abernathy and his eloquent and generous introduction, and then thought about myself, I wondered who he was talking about. It's always good to have your closest friend and associate to say something good about you. And Ralph Abernathy is the best friend that I have in the world. I'm delighted to see each of you here tonight in spite of a storm warning. You reveal that you are determined to go on anyhow. Something is happening in Memphis. Something is happening in our world. And you know, if I was standing at the beginning of time with the possibility of taking a kind of general and panoramic view of the whole of human history up to now, and the Almighty said to me, Martin Luther King, which age would you like to live in? I would take my mental flight by Egypt. And I would watch God's children in their magnificent trek from the dark dungeons of Egypt through, or rather across the Red Sea, through the wilderness on toward the Promised Land. And in spite of its magnificence, I wouldn't stop there. I would move on by Greece and take my mind to Mount Olympus. And I would see Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Euripides, and Aristophanes assemble around the Parthenon. I would watch them around the Parthenon as they discussed the great and eternal issue of reality, but I wouldn't stop there. I would go on even to the great heyday of the Roman Empire. And I would see developments around there through various emperors and leaders, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the day of the Renaissance and get a quick picture of all that the Renaissance did for the cultural and aesthetic life of man, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even go by the way that the man for whom I'm named had his habitat. And I would watch Martin Luther as he tacked his 95 theses on the door at the Church of Wittenberg, but I wouldn't stop there. I would come on up even to 1863 and watch a vacillating president by the name of Abraham Lincoln finally come to the conclusion that he had to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the early 30s and see a man grappling with the problems of the bankruptcy of his nation. Come with an eloquent cry that we have nothing to fear but fear itself, but I wouldn't stop there. Strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy. Now, that's a strange statement to make because the world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land. Confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up. And wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free. Another reason that I'm happy to live in this period is that we have been forced to a point where we're going to have to grapple with the problems that men have been trying to grapple with through history, but the demands didn't force them to do it. Survival demands that we grapple with it. Men for years now have been talking about war and peace, but now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer the cause between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existent. That is where we are today. Also in the human rights revolution. If something isn't done and done in a hurry to bring the colored peoples of the world out of their long years of poverty, By long years of hurt and neglect, the whole world is doomed. Now, I'm just happy that God has allowed me to live in this period, to see what is unfolding. And I'm happy that he's allowed me to be in Memphis. I can remember when Negroes were just going around, as Ralph had said, so often scratching where they didn't hit and laughing when they were not tickled. But that day is all over. We mean business now, and we are determined to gain our rightful place in God's world. And that's all this whole thing is about. We aren't engaged in any negative protest and in any negative arguments with anybody. We are saying that we are determined to be men. We are determined to be people. We are saying, that we are God's children. And if we are God's children, we don't have to live like we are forced to live. Now, what does all of this mean in this great period of history? It means that we've got to stay together. We've got to stay together and maintain unity. You know, whenever Pharaoh wanted to prolong the period of slavery in Egypt, he had a favorite formula for doing it. What was that? He kept the slaves fighting among themselves. But whenever the slaves get together, something happens in Pharaoh's court, and he cannot hold the slaves in slavery. When the slaves get together, that's the beginning of getting out of slavery. Now let us maintain unity. Secondly, let us keep the issues where they are. The issue is injustice. The issue is the refusal of Memphis to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servants who happen to be sanitation workers. Now, we've got to keep attention on that. That's always the problem with a little violence. You know what happened the other day, and the press dealt only with the window breaking. I read the article. They very seldom got around to mentioning the fact that 1,300 sanitation workers are on strike, and that Memphis is not being fair to them, and that Mayor Loeb is in dire need of a doctor. They didn't get around to that. Now we're going to march again, and we've got to march again, in order to put the issue where it is supposed to be. Force everybody to see that there are 1,300 of God's children here suffering. Sometimes going hungry, going through dark and dreary nights,
wondering how this thing is going to come out. That's the issue. We've got to say to the nation, we know how it's coming out. When people get caught up with that which is right and they are willing to sacrifice for it, there is no stopping for it. Shout of victory. We aren't going to let any may stop us. We are masters in our nonviolent movement in disarming police forces. They don't know what to do. I've seen them so often. I remember in Birmingham, Alabama, we were in that majestic struggle there. We would move out of the 16th Street Baptist Church day after day. By the hundreds, we would move out, and Bill Connell would tell them to send the dogs for us. And they did come. But we just went before the dogs singing, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." Bill Connell next would say, "Turn the fire hoses on." As I said to you the other night, Bull Connor didn't know history. He knew a kind of physics that somehow didn't relate to the transphysics that we knew about. And that was the fact that there was a certain kind of fire that no water could put out. And we went before the fire hose. We had known water. If we were Baptist or some other denomination, we had been immersed. If we were Methodist and some other, we had been sprinkled, but we knew water. That couldn't stop us. And we just went on before the dogs, and we would look at them, and we'd go on before the water hoses, and we would look at it. And we just go on singing, "Over my head, I see freedom in there." Then we would be thrown into paddy wagons. And sometimes we would stack them there like sardines in a can. They would throw us in, and old Bull would say, "Take them all." They did. And we would just go on in the paddy wagon singing, "We shall overcome." And every now and then we'd get in jail and we'd see the jailer looking through the windows, being moved by our prayer and being moved by our words and our song. There was a power there which Bull Connor couldn't adjust to. So we ended up transforming Bull into a steer, and we won our struggle in Birmingham. We've got to go on in Memphis just like that. I call upon you to be with us when we go out Monday. Now about injunctions. We have an injunction and we're going into court tomorrow morning to fight this illegal, unconstitutional injunction. All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over that. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest our rights. So that's if I say we aren't gonna let it stop. A water hose is turning us around. We aren't gonna let any injunction turn us around. We are going on. We need all of you. You know what's beautiful to me? It's to see all of these ministers of the gospel. It's a marvelous picture. Who is it that is supposed to articulate the longings and aspirations of the people more than the preacher? Somehow the preacher must have a kind of fire set up in his bones. And whenever injustice is around, he must tell it. Somehow the preacher must be an Amos. Said when God speaks, who can but prophesy? Again with Amos, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Somehow the preacher must say with Jesus, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me. And he's anointed me to deal with the problems of the poor. And I want to commend the preacher. Under the leadership of these noble men, James Lawson, one who has been in this struggle for many years. He's been to jail for struggling. He's been kicked out of Vanderbilt University for this struggling, but he's still going on fighting for the rights of his people. Reverend Ralph Jackson, Billy Kyle, I could just go right on down the list. Time will not permit, but I want to thank all of them. And I want you to thank them. Because so often, preachers aren't concerned about anything but themselves. And I'm always happy to see a relevant ministry. It's all right to talk about long white robes over yonder in all of its symbolism. But ultimately, people want some suits and dresses and shoes to wear down here. It's all right to talk about streets flowing with milk and honey. But God has commanded us to be concerned about the slums down here and his children who can't eat 3 square meals a day. It's all right to talk about the New Jerusalem, but one day God's preacher must talk about the new New York, the new Atlanta, the new Philadelphia, the new Los Angeles, the new Memphis, Tennessee. This is what we have to do. Now, the other thing we'll have to do is this. Always anchor our external direct action with the power of economic control. We are poor people. Individually, we are poor when you compare with white society in America. We are poor. Never stop. Forget that collectively, that means all of us together, collectively we are richer than all the nations in the world with the exception of mine. Did you ever think about that? After you leave the United States, so that Russia, Great Britain, West Germany, France, I can name others. The American Negro collectively is richer than most nations in the world. We have an annual income of more than $30 billion a year, which is more than all of the exports of the United States and more than the national budget of Canada. Did you know that? That's power right there if we know how to do it. We don't have to argue with anybody. We don't have to curse and go around acting bad with our words. We don't need any bricks and bubbles. We don't need any Molotov cocktails. We just need to go around to these stores and to these massive industries in our community. Say, God, finish right here. To say to you that you're not treating us children right. And we come by here to ask you to make the first item on your agenda bad treatment where God's children are concerned. Now, if you are not prepared to do that, we do have an agenda that we must follow. And our agenda calls for withdrawing economic support from you. So as a result of this, we are asking you tonight to go out and tell your neighbors not to buy Coca-Cola anymore. Go by and tell them not to buy steel testament. Tell them not to buy what is all the bread, Wonder Bread. And what is all the bread from the president? Tell them not to buy hard bread. Justice Jackson has said, up to now, only the garbage men have been feeling pain. Now we must kind of redistribute the pain. We are choosing these companies because they have been paying our hiring policies. We are choosing them because they can begin the process of saying they are going to support the needs and the rights of these men who are on the track. And then they can move on town, downtown, and tell Mayor Lowe to do what is right. And not only that, we got to strengthen black institutions. I call upon you to take your money out of the bank downtown and deposit your money in Tri-State Bank. We want a bank-in movement in Memphis. Go by the savings and loan association. I'm not asking you something that we don't do ourselves in SCLC. Your books and others will tell you that we have an account here in the savings and loan association from the Southern Christian Leadership Council. We are telling you to follow what we are doing. Put your money back. You have 6 to 7 black insurance companies here in the city of Memphis. Take out your insurance now. We want to have an insurance in. Now these are some practical things that we can do. We begin the process of building a free economic base. And at the same time, we are putting pressure where it really hurts. I ask you to follow through here. Now let me say as I move to my conclusion that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We got to see it through. When we have our march, we need to be there. If it means leaving work, if it means leaving school, be there. Be concerned about your brother. You may not be on track, but either we go up together or we go down together. Let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. One day a man came to Jesus. He wanted to raise some questions about some vital matters of life. Of course, he wanted to question, confirm that he knew a little more than Jesus knew, and form our faith. Now, that question could have easily ended up in a philosophical and theological debate. But Jesus immediately pulled that question from midair and placed it on the dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho. He talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. You remember that a Levite, the priest passed by on the other side. They didn't stop to help him. Finally, a man of another race came by, got down from his feet, decided not to be compassionate by custom, but he got down with him, administered first aid, and helped the man in need. Jesus ended up saying, this was the good man, this was the great man, because he had the capacity to project the eye into the vine to be concerned about his brother. Now, you know, we use our imagination a great deal to try to determine why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. The times we say they were busy going to a church meeting and ecclesiastical gathering, and they had to get on down to Jerusalem so they wouldn't be late for their meeting. At other times, we would speculate that there was a religious law that one who was engaged in religious ceremonials, not to touch a human body 24 hours before the ceremony. And every now and then we begin to wonder whether maybe they were not going down to Jerusalem, down to Jericho rather, to organize a Jericho Road Improvement Association. That's a possibility. Maybe they felt that it was better to deal with the problem from the causal root rather than to get bogged down with an individual effect. But I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible that those men were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road. I remember when Mrs. King and I were first in Jerusalem. We rented a car and drove from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And as soon as we got on that road, I said to my wife, I can see why Jesus used it as the setting for his parable. It's a winding, meandering road. It's really conducive for ambush. We start out in Jerusalem, which is about 1,200 miles, or rather 1,200 feet above sea level. And by the time you get down to Jericho, 15 or 20 minutes later, you're about 2,200 feet below sea level. That's a dangerous road. In the days of Jesus, it came to be known as the bloody path. You know it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. It's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy peace. So the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came back, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation worker, what will happen to my daughter? Not if I stop to help the sanitation worker, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not, if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation worker, what will happen to them? That's the question. Let us rise up tonight with a greater reverence. Let us stand with a greater determination. Let us move on in these powerful days, these days of challenge, to make America what it ought to be. We have an opportunity to make America a better nation. I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you. You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. While sitting there autographing books, the minute black woman came up, the only question I heard from her was, you Martin Luther King, and I was looking down writing, and I said, yes. The next minute, I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through and x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my ear, of the main artery. Once that's conscious, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of it. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after the operation, after my chest had been opened and the blade had been taken out, to move around in the wheelchair in the hospital. They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in, and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I received a visit and a letter from the governor. So this morning I would like to use as a subject call letter to American Christians. Call letter to American Christians. I would like to share with you an imaginary letter from the pen of the Apostle Paul, the postmark revealed that it comes from the island of Crete. And after noticing and opening the letter, I discovered that it was written in ill-formed, crawling Greek. At the top of the letter was written in French. Read so that people, when they assemble themselves together and add mass to the other church, I have labored with the translation for several days. At times it has been difficult, but now I think I have it covered. And it's been given that now the content sounds strangely similar rather than Paulinian, attributed to my lack of objectivity rather than Paul's lack of character. It is quite miraculous indeed that the Apostle Paul should be writing a letter to you and me 1900 years after his last letter appeared in the New Testament. How that is possible, I do not know. I do not really care. The important thing is that I can imagine Paul speaking to us in 1956, speaking to American Christians. And here is the letter as it stands before me. I am apostle of Jesus Christ to the will of God, to you who are in America. Grace and peace be unto you through our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. I have longed to be able to come to see you. I have heard of you and what you are doing. I have heard of the fascinating and astounding advances that you have made in the scientific and the material realm. I have heard of your aeroplanes. I have heard about the fact that through your scientific genius, you have been able to walk distance and save time and energy. Yes, you have been able to carve highways through the stratosphere. And so in your world, you have made it possible to eat breakfast in London, England, and lunch in New York City. I have heard about your skyscraping buildings. Without power of speaking heavenward, as if the veil that peaks in the lofty blue. I have heard of your great medical science and all of your advances in the medical realm. So you have been able to cure many great plagues and diseases, and thereby to prolong your life and bring about greater security and physical well-being. All of that is wonderful. You can do things now that could not be done in the Greco-Roman world of my day. You can make journeys now in one day that it took me 3 months to make. That is wonderful. You have gone a long, long way in material advances. But America, I am wondering, as I look at you from afar, whether or not you have gone as far in the spirit of the moral realm. Seems to me, America, that although you have advanced scientifically and materially, you lag behind spiritually and morally. Your approach to the world is to talk about improved means to an unimproved end. And often that is true. You have allowed the material means by which you live to outdistance the spiritual end far which you live. You have allowed your mentality to outrun your morality. You have allowed your civilization to outdistance your culture. Yes, America, My plea to you in America is to be maladjusted. I understand that you have a great economic system in America that you call capitalism. Through that economic system, you have been able to do wonders. You have been able to build up the richest nation in the world. Through that system, you have been able to build up the greatest productive system that the world has ever known. And all of that's fine. But America, that is the danger that you will misuse your capitalism. I'm not an economist, and I cannot criticize your economic system from the point of view of the economist, but I can criticize.